I had an interesting inquiry-like dialogue the other day on the phone.
Fun. What happened?
Question was, it would be nice, the person, be nice if I could be in the God space, you know, experiencing what I know to be that God connection.
Mm.
And my response is sort of inquiry-like and saying, how do you know that reference point is an accurate indicator of anything?
Hmm. Touché. That's a sharp Zen sword right there.
I said, what? I don't understand. I said, it's not easy to understand because self-referencing is like, I don't know, second nature.
It's like water.
Yeah, it's like water.
It's like where goldfish live.
Yep. So it was interesting to kind of step back in a way,
uh-huh,
and look at the
Hi.
Look at the measuring sticks.
Yes.
The little weights, standards and weights.
Stand. Yeah. Department of Standards and Measures.
You throw something on the scale and you go, oh, there it is.
Yeah. Yeah. There's my God realization right there.
Yep. 21 grams.
Uh huh. Yeah. How much lighter is the body when the soul leaves?
Yeah, that was all made up, too.
The kinetic energy, the heat energy that lives? Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Was that called 21 grams?
It was.
Okay. That's what we amount to, right? 21 grams of exhalation.
We should give out T-shirts to say, smoke me in 21 grams.
Yes. Smoking.
There was a movie with that name, right?
Yes.
It was a good movie, I think, right?
Yeah.
I think it was.
Was it on drugs, I think?
Was it as Sean Penn? He was dying, and there was just some phrase in there that has nothing to do with reality, but when the body dies, why does it lose 21 grams of weight? And it's like, it's a hook.
Yeah.
Well, the movie's about drugs, though, wasn't it?
You know, I honestly don't remember anything else.
Sign of a good movie.
Great movie.
The title and the weight, you know.
Yeah.
And that it was made up. It set an intriguing wheel going.
Yeah.
The movie said that the quote was made up?
Yeah. There was this first-person narration
on
a person who had died or was died or what her died or even before he died. Making that statement.
Yeah, okay.
But I guess if you're more enlightened, it might be like 50 grams.
Yeah, I think you get heavier the more enlightened you are. That's right.
I mean, I guess it is technically correct. Like, you know, like, is your body, when it's dead, like, you know, no one would say, like, you're still there. But when it's alive and you got, like, whatever electricity and shit moving around, like, that 21 grams of heat energy, I mean, that technically is the difference between, you and the dead corpse.
Yeah, right. The spark and the non-spark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
It has some gravitational relationship.
Mm-hmm.
21 grams worth.
Yeah.
I watched Arrival last week, and that was a sick movie.
Oh, good. You saw it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sick?
Oh, yeah. It was so good.
Oh, good.
Yeah. You didn't see it?
No, but I'm looking forward to it.
Sorry, my millennial is showing.
It's good to see it. That's like awesome.
I was picking up what you were putting down.
Yeah, I got to get up with the times.
Yeah, it was totally sick. Yeah, I saw it. I saw it twice, yeah. It was worth seeing it a second time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a movie you could. I only watched maybe the intro or so again, but there's enough in there that it's worth a second watching.
Yeah.
Because there's so much that's happening, it's all like, oh, you know, sort of whatever, you're getting something out of it, but then after you see the whole thing, you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
It's all very carefully placed.
Yeah. Yes.
I like how she just put herself right out there and revealed herself.
Mm-hmm.
So, but communicate, I gotta show them that I'm not this suit.
Yeah, that was just great. Yeah.
What?
Really. If they made it all the way here and they wanted to do harm, they probably would have already, so we may as well just
go with it.
Full Monty.
Find the person to figure it out, man. Somebody's got to test it.
Yeah.
That's why I like that quote at the end of the movie, Europa. What is one human life worth compared to the breadth of all human knowledge?
Mm.
He, like, takes his suit off to get a look at this thing they've been exploring. That's a great movie, too.
Europa.
You know, Europa Report, sorry.
Mm.
But, like, apparently no one has seen it. Like, it's went by, like, largely unnoticed. But
is that recent?
No, it's, well, I mean, maybe 10 years old, I guess, 5, I'm not sure.
I'd go back and find it.
That was an incredible movie. Yeah, Europa Report.
That's one of the planets around Jupiter.
It's one of the moons around Jupiter. Is it on Jupiter? Maybe.
I think it's a Jupiter moon, yeah.
One or two, right?
No, there's a ton on.
Are there a lot of Jupiter moons?
If it's, it might not be Jupiter. Is it
Saturn? No.
One of the big planets out there. It's got a ton of moons, and this is supposed to be one of the ones that's like most Earth-like, maybe. Light crowd today.
Yeah.
Any
warm weather.
What's that?
Warm weather.
Nice. Any more communications from you're talking to somebody on the meetup page?
No.
That was quite an intro you provided. I mean, technically correct.
Technically correct, right?
That's right. Anything goes, basically.
But like what you put out there is so, I mean, I don't want to say random, but just so varying. Like your presentation, I don't know what you want to call it, but
it's like a non-stick surface.
The other night he was writing something on Facebook, right? And I'm sitting next to him checking Facebook or whatever. And I'm sitting there going, or I was watching a movie, and I'm like, this, then I was reading later what he wrote, and I'm like, he writes this while I'm watching Grey's Anatomy, most likely. You know, I'm sitting here watching this, and then meanwhile he's over there generating in a whole big thing.
Tickling the ethers.
Yeah, well, when you're not so self-consumed, then you know, there's a flood, really, a flood of insight. That's you're made out of a flood of insight, right? But that gets all of the improvisational poetry gets drowned out by the habit of being self-consumed.
Yeah, well, there's no difference between writing about what you're writing and watching Grey's Anatomy. In that sense, it's the self. It's the same thing of self-consumption happening.
I was listening to this psychologist talk, Jordan Peterson, and he was talking about the Bret the Hitman Hart documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I think he went crazy and killed his wife and kids or something. I don't know. Maybe it was a different wrestler, but anyway, something happened. But he was describing how he finally understood the appeal of all this like fake wrestling, WWF stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it was that, you know, certain percent of the population is borderline incapable of reading, but the same archetypal stories that speak to people in the higher forms of literature and communication are just represented on one more lower form.
Yes.
And that was like, you know, the same thing.
Yeah.
That you're getting it like in these more like base forms of entertainment and how you
right.
found the, or, you know, was able to find the like depth and importance of the dramas they play out there. And
yeah.
Like in the Coliseum.
Yes.
Sure.
Coliseum consciousness. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's a good one.
Well, that's how we're still living.
Well,
just go to a rally.
Yeah, depends on what, you know.
See, they didn't have the internet back then.
Yeah. Yeah, how did they know when to show up at the Coliseum? Pamphlets?
It's only one show in town, right?
I guess when the crowd gathered, they're there to find out what they're looking at.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's strange. Like, keeping track of time is only like 200 some years old. Like,
wow.
People, like, I think it was back, yeah, like in, you know, 1800s that, you know, weren't strictly schedule driven, you know, this and that. And
Yeah.
How anybody did anything like that. I'll see.
Well, the lunar
days or
the lunar cycle, right, has been relied on for quite some time.
Yeah.
Without the, what do we call? What's the calendar considered?
Gregorian.
Greek, yeah. Greco-Roman calendar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that, or whatever.
All right.
But yeah, it's funny, like the way you know, society and life is structured now is just so new, so modern, and so foreign compared to what it was just very recently.
Very recently.
Yeah, 100-150 years is like, you know, it's like nothing.
It's blippo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before 7 days a week or, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They had 5 days of no time to balance out things.
They needed.
Logically.
Yeah.
When there was 13 moon cycles.
Right.
And then instead of leap years and all that stuff, it was just this no time from November 1st to 5th or something.
Oh, neat.
And people did whatever. You know,
wow.
Off the clock.
And even when they first got clocks, every town basically had their own time for people synced up to whatever the main clock was. And there was no need to sync all of them, like in London versus, like, I don't know, whatever the city in England there is. It would be like, you know, half an hour off or whatever. It was only when they started running trains back and forth they realized, okay, you can't have this city on one schedule.
We better.
You need to start linking them. And then I forget what procedure they used to get everybody linked up on the same time. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of entered into the modern age.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, that's part of the allure of the alchemy of liberation.
Yeah, it seems like this would maybe wind you up and make you a little more uncomfortable, and potentially, I don't know.
Well, the
coercion, the unseating, or
yeah, the
forceful way,
the imposition of
it's a bug.
Of clock time,
yeah,
right, can well recede. Yeah, I mean our persona, whatever that is, you know, so curiously conditioned by perception and conception and the artifacts of a complex culture. Yeah, so we lose a taste of unstructured freedom because we align with the conveniences of a so-called modern culture. Uh-huh. And so, of course, the you know, the fallout, the neurosis of that habituation contributes to existential restlessness. Yeah. Yeah. Returning, in a manner of speaking, to unstructured ambience. Consciousness as ambience, unstructured ambience, can restore, well, if you want to be prophetic about it, you know, restore us to sanity, which is a phrase used in recovery rooms, right? To be restored to sanity. Yeah. Yeah, there has to be, or not that there has to be, but let's say there, you can report that there commonly appears to be a certain constructive disdain for repetitive thinking and repetitive behavior and the repetition of anticipation, the repetition of persona. certain disdain, healthy disdain, constructive disdain, arises to be a motivating force for us to, you know, take some kind of steps to return to unstructured ambience. And unstructured ambience, the dawning of it and the sipping of it releases one from creature-oriented identification and space-time orientation and manipulation and bargaining and denial and all of the stages of death, stages of grief. Yeah, it's and that refresh, ambient, unstructured ambient consciousness has no limit. There's no limitation because it's non-referential. So you keep falling. And early on in that adventure, there might be the reflex to grasp at the well wall to stop falling. You know, grab a limb, grab a brick, grab anything. Keep one's fingers tight on the lip. So as not to fall, once we become a little more acquainted with the falling, which is no falling at all, then we learn how to relax our defense. Become more friendly with and trusting of unstructured ambient consciousness.
He's doing laps.
He's sparring.
Is there a stink bug or something?
Yeah, yeah. It looks like a
roly poly
poo bug. Taking the long way.
I think it's like his fourth loop by now.
Does he stay on the same color?
He stays about in the same spot, yeah.
I can relate, man. I relate.
I relate, yeah. I relate. Hey, thanks, man. I relate.
A little Ramana Maharshi.
Solid message. High five.
Walking around there with Arunachala.
Yeah, it's just Ramana walking around Arunachala, yeah.
He always cuts the inside there, though.
Oh, there's a snack bar over there.
I think the last time we watched the bug, he flew right into the flame.
Really?
That happens.
I don't think this type is inclined to be moved by the light.
We'll soon see.
He climbed up, the snake bug climbed up the candle. He kind of leaned inward.
There's probably a bit of convection there.
And then it was an aromatic candle.
Yeah, it's a new flavor. You can get it from Yankee Candles. Stink bug.
Stink bug. <That's good.
laughs> What are you selling this for? Novel idea. Consciousness is like Ulysses' sirens. Consciousness is singing a very, very seductive tune. And all of the sensuality of present experience is that song. That's what you're feeling. That's what you're hearing. Is the song of the sirens.
if you're lucky, it's a sensual experience.
Well,
it's usually more mundane than that, it seems.
Well, you know, we call it mundane because we're not paying close enough attention. But if we, let's say, withdraw from the convenient value judgment of mundane, which we, of course, can all relate to, then this is unbearable. That's how sensual it is. It's really actually unbearable. And we habituate to it by more or less tuning out.
We form a structure of some sort.
Yeah, we tune out. We tune out, and then we become, we groove into a interpretive structure.
It's too raw.
Yeah, that's right. It's excruciating. And not necessarily in a good or bad way, just in terms of the magnitude, the volume of actual experience is, holy shit, it's completely riveting. But we withdraw from that by education or karma or, you know, who knows why or how or if even anything's happening at all. We withdraw from it and then easily turn this, you know, this blissful sacred moment, unstructured ambient bliss into the mundane. How do we pull that off?
A lot of secrets to tell about.
A lot of secrets. Yeah. Hmm. And that's, you know, contributory to the extent that it is. I mean, Paul Hederman right about now would go on a jag about selfing. So, which is, you know, a lovely monologue, and it's always full of unexpected left turns and jokes and makes you laugh because he's just so good at it.
And familiarity with Paul.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're, well, exploring the same thing, but not from the same call it context, because even selfing is I would say a downstream symptom of something that's more subtle and more fundamental than the symptoms of selfing. But it's more challenging to come up with a cogent vocabulary or articulation of those subtler realms, because most of us are unfamiliar with that kind of a revelation. We are comfortable being an egomaniac and all of the funny and disturbing ways that we are an egomaniac. So when you make fun in a humorous way of being an egomaniac, people can more easily relate to that. When you look at Eckhart Tolle's Pain Body, I mean, everyone jumped on that shit like, you know, he's talking about me, right? Yeah, because everyone could relate to this more symptomatic, if not superficial, portrayal of the angst of, you know, living.
I could see him selling t-shirts. Got pain?
Got pain? Yeah. No. And he does. He sells them. He sells calendars, you know, the power of now. Want to buy a calendar? What?
Yeah, I think what you're saying, it's like if you shift your perception into, I don't know what people are normally doing, then, like, yeah, all the shit that happens afterwards, and then people, like, talk about that, and it's like...
Yes.
It's too late at that point.
It's way too late.
Yeah.
But it's where most so-called people, you know, can find a common ground to relate to.
Yeah.
I, you know, take a certain delight in shifting the bar and shifting the emphasis from, you know, more gross symptom to something that's of a lower or least common denominator, where my bias, I feel you can get more mileage from it. Yeah, because it's easy to entrain to, let's just call it the colloquial frustrations of the pain body. And then voyeuristically read other stories about other people's so-called pain bodies, which either you identify with or you're happy that you're not suffering in that same way. But it, but that kind of a voyeurism doesn't really assist you. It's too superficial.
Yeah.
So how do you bring it home so that it's way more personal? And if you are dealing or struggling with the content of your own imaginary consciousness, then you remain, once again, somewhat superficial and driven by the myth of a remedial response. So if you are remedying the myth of yourself, it's like sticking a straw in a pile of sand, imagining that it is full of fresh water. And that's just not going to suit you very well.
Grainy picture.
Yeah.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey.
Lily wanted to be saying something in the chat room, and she said it looks like it's closed. Is that true?
I don't know. I went into the so-called chat room, and I wrote a little something. I don't know. She might have to log in with her Gmail address. How did you find out about this? Through Facebook? Oh, texted you? She has to log in with her Gmail address, and then she'll see the broadcast, and then she can chat, I think.
Whatever your YouTube account is, I don't think it has to be Gmail.
Oh.
Just Google account, I mean. Well, I guess you're... No, I guess
that is a Gmail.
No, because I don't have Gmail on my Google account. I've never set it up.
Okay.
I don't necessarily need that. I have my YouTube before that. Whatever she has, it probably is Gmail.
I think she needs to sign in some way so that if she does see the broadcast, it will give her permission to use the chat
window. She is watching
window.
The broadcast.
Well, good.
And she regularly watches these, and I mean Peter, so she knows how to put in the chat room, but
yeah.
It's closed to her.
I don't know what to do about it. I can give it some attention some other time. So what does it mean then to go, deeper into the curious presentation of present experience? Discover the challenge, the utility of weaning oneself from narrative consciousness.
The chat works.
Okay. So that's the one practical level of challenge. If you're let's say dismantling the myth of present experience.
You know, a meditation has been prescribed for that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how successful it is for most people, probably. Not
yeah.
Very.
Uh-huh.
And whether it's a misunderstanding of meditation itself,
yeah.
What the goals are, the goals, you know, maybe because there are goals, you know.
Yeah.
There's a desirable state of mind that you're after, or there's
something
you have to repeat without being bored, and you know there's all these
like mantra meditation.
Yeah.
Well, those are useful vehicles for a beginner's mind to become acquainted with the texture of mindfulness, or
yeah.
You know, what might be referred to as inquiry.
Well, and it's interesting because you say a beginner's approach, because that's true. I remember seeing somebody, I talked about this ages ago, about that I saw who hooked you all up with electrodes and stuff, and she was telling me about
that. Sounds like Scientology.
It was kind of fun because I was looking for some validation about my meditation.
Of course.
And
I'll give you some.
Yeah.
Your meditation sucks.
I got that one.
It's no good.
but she told me after the fact that she there was one person that she hooked up, and it's really clear with the way the alpha and
yeah,
it's very clear. And this person was just like straight thinking mind, and they're like, she's like, well, how was that meditation? Yeah, it's great, you know. It's like
no indication.
No indication that if they ever left just their rambling mind.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
And it's usually pretty clear.
Yes.
I had thought that, like, actually where I read this, but somebody said even when you think you're, like, meditating long, like, it's usually, like, good anyway. But I guess, you know, if you're trying to, like, measure changes in, you know, brainwave output, then maybe you're not ever
If you're thinking along a certain line, and I don't remember, not that I ever really knew that well, the different ways, delta, theta, alpha, whatever, beta. But they go in a different way. I mean, they really look different. I mean, it's a more holistic thing because it's taking every part of your processing melds into sort of a uniform whole.
And that might have just been the teacher's way of saying, like, it's working, but it's just working on your level of getting to, like, where other people would normally
stay. But the idea, the beginner's level, because you would have to think, I don't know, but there seems to be a progression, you know, so somebody that's a master in meditation, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, you can see that. But I think that after a while, whatever tricks you had to get to that place in the first place, if you want to call them tricks, that's a little crass. They take you to a certain point, but
we are.
And then maybe that meditation is the wrong word. Maybe it's every day.
You're gonna find objects in your subjectivity all the way down, and we remain inebriated by the miracle of finding objects in our subjectivity. And we associate ourselves with that for, you know, validation, for reinforcement as concerns body, mind, self, space and time, implication, progress, right? Yeah. So then one, through those practices, though they have their, you know, contributory value, one is still understandably clinging to the myth of individuated subjectivity. And begins to encounter moments or visitations of discontinuity. And likes, I would dare say, and likes and enjoys those visitations of discontinuity, but doesn't yet have the, let's call it the experiential vocabulary or the, you know, so-called spiritual vocabulary to place those discontinuities in a cogent perspective.
So, but that's all after the fact. Putting it into any perspective.
Yeah, putting anything into any perspective is both so-called present and after the fact.
Yeah, there must be some desire to want to communicate or relate to what just happened, either to self
absolutely,
or to a common
group. Yeah, even if it's quest, just to quest. Try to deal with it, understand, put your hands around it.
Yeah. So we pass through those, you know, wave forms, and those can be decades long.
It's like a different type of communication, though, right?
No question. Yeah.
You're not, like, downplaying this game again. Like, you're, like, talking about the game itself, perhaps, I guess. Rather than, like, taking the form of some character and, like, fighting the other characters, essentially.
Well, yeah, you're peeling off your avatar. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, present experience does not convey or condemn you to being corporeal. And that could be a startling revelation or insight. Well, look at all the things that frame one as a viable person who, for some strange reason, got out of bed today and bathed or didn't and put clothes on and interfaced with other so-called human beings as a wage earner or consumer or both. And then, you know, wants to, before retiring at night, spend a little time having a spiritual conversation. You're, let's say, always invited to peel off your avatar and become more intimate, texturally, sensually, and super sensually intimate with the curious, unsought demonstration of present experience as a wave form of miraculous, if not excruciating, sensuality, which includes all ideation and all emotion and sensitivity and bodily sensation.
It includes it, but it's not fixated by it.
No fixation. Yeah, that's lovely. Yeah. Uh-huh. No fixation.
You know, it seems like the dissatisfaction doesn't really go away. It just changes in its type. It gets a little more purified or something like that. Whereas you might be pissed off and, you know,
yeah,
in a grosser way. But now you're just like,
yeah,
you recognize the general dissatisfaction with, like, everything you have planned out for today.
That's, you could say that's what the Buddha was getting at,
yes,
through reference to dukkha.
Yeah, I know, it might get more refined, but there's pretty much this general level of dissatisfaction. Speaking for myself only.
Well, it's a worthwhile reformation in character.
Yeah.
And intimacy to back off from either being the victim or the perpetrator, and get down with one's, you know, the pressure of one's existential being.
Exactly, yes.
Yes?
Right.
Yeah. And to see whether the immediacy, uninvited, unsought, right, pressure of existential intimacy is pleasing or satisfying or somehow less than that. And we do our best to avoid and ignore this intimate encounter by habituating to frivolity and imagination and, you know, unimaginable hubris. It's kind of like, if you're not going to be or not capable or not interested or by grace not invited to have a seat at your own table and deal with the immediacy of the texture of present experience, then, you know, you will remain superficial and the product of your own superstitions. The reason the metaphor of the dark night of the soul, you could say, you know, exists or can be found in so many stories of personal catharsis, I would say, is illustrative of an intimate encounter with existential restlessness, the pressure of being. That's where, that's referred to as tapas, heat. Yeah, it's heat. Just like you would drill toward the core of the earth, not too far down, it becomes impossible to withstand the heat and the humidity, both of which will conspire to kill you without notice. So similarly, if we are drilling down into the core of our own being, tapas, heat, humidity, the excruciating nature of present experience will be revealed. If you've gone into the cave, if you don't go into the cave of yourself, then you can avoid this encounter, or may not avoid this encounter to the so-called grave. Why systems like transcendental meditation and other things promise low blood pressure, low stress, less sleep, and greater joy through fornication. Really? Where do I sign up? Here's my handkerchief, and here's my $50. Here's a fresh apple. Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, and let's go.
What if I wanted more sleep?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't
know.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking that same thing.
Well, I think you just repeat your mantra in reverse. Salam quack. Mo. Moo. Fuck. Then you get higher blood pressure. It's like country song. You get your job back, you get your dog back, you get your truck back, you get your girlfriend back. Too much fun. So you see, we have an encounter, an invitation with this tapas, with the core heat and humidity of the profundity of present experience, and we have to nothing, wake up, buck up, let that encounter reveal what it is capable of revealing to us, rather than fleeing from it reflexively.
Well, if you flee from it, I mean, I guess it's just going to stay there.
Where is it going? That's right.
It's just going to come back.
If you flee, which of course occurs most often semi or unconsciously, right? The fleeing interferes with the shamanic capacity for transmutation, which requires heat, tapas, and some degree of durability for it to transmute under the profound gaze of your own awareness. If you're fleeing, then it doesn't have the chance to, right, mature. Diamonds are not made because a bunch of carbon keeps you running away. The carbon stays in place and gets fucking
really pressed
baked. Yeah. Baked, right, under unimaginable combination of heat and pressure.
Sure.
And that transmutes the carbon into, right,
crystal clarity,
diamond,
a worthless, very common rock hoarded by one family.
One family, the De Beers. Thank you, South America, South Africa. Yeah, yeah. Right. Uh huh. Yeah. So the same metamorphosis is a great metaphor for one's own spiritual adventure. You have to rest, grapple with, deal with the heat and the pressure of present experience, the tapasya, for it to crystallize, mutate, and in that case become a conduit for light. Lengthy meditation retreats are, you know, one way to expose yourself voluntarily to a certain kind of sensory deprivation, which amplifies one's encounter with tapasya, you know, these vipassana retreats. And since this transmutative, shamanic and transmutative adventure is without cause and without time, you don't necessarily have to expose yourself to a lengthy meditation retreat or sensory deprivation experience to get very intimate with the heat of your present experience. And that, of course, again, is a maturing process, right? Early on, we use various tools and means to do our best to be warmed up. And as, you know, our life experience unfolds, we discover that the entrance to the cave is right at hand. So you can tune into the riveting nature of present experience, weaning oneself from narrative consciousness to behold.
If the self has practiced so long and so hard its own importance,
yes.
How suddenly does that get out of the way?
Well, it can look like, you know, decades or lifetimes, or, not to be glib about it, instantaneous. You see, because for as long as we're under the influence of a field of imagination, then we believe in time and causality, and let's call it the observation of a ripening process. But all of that, and all of that, folds with remarkable effortlessness as you just drop spontaneously into referencelessness. In which case, though it may appear to take decades or lifetimes, it takes no time at all. So your liberation is exactly this. Not so much even at hand, but it is exactly this, right? Because at hand suggests, right, another moment, another gesture, another catharsis. No. There is no moment or gesture or catharsis. Your liberation is exactly this. So you do nothing. You never have done anything.
Including selfing in a very strong way.
Nothing. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I'm thinking of it. I've been reading about Bearheart. It's a Native American shaman I met a long time ago. Just coincidence onto a book.
Uh-huh.
And he was picked by two clans to continue the medicine as they were getting older. So in his teen years, he'd go to one month and another the other. So he goes to the house after he fasted for 3 days. And the teacher ignores him for half a day.
Sweet.
And he's thinking, am I in the right place? I mean, really? Am I supposed to be here? What's going on? And, he goes,
yeah.
And then he decides, well, I think I'll just wait and just be present. And then he's addressed.
Uh-huh.
He says, it took you that long to get yourself out of the way.
Wow.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the other teacher, too, fast for 3 days and then let's go into the woods. And he goes, see that tree over there? Hug that tree and I'll be back later for you.
Yeah, for a month.
Oh, what's going on? I mean, what?
Yeah.
If my friends saw me now, I my reputation would be shit.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Fast forward a little bit. It had to do with tweaking powers of observation, getting past maybe the selfing stories,
yes,
of sorts.
Right.
But at the same time, there can be an enamored degree of the subtle self importance of Medicine Man, or of I did this.
Hey, this,
there, as
this,
opposed to I'm an ordinary Joe.
This is the sirens.
I lost myself in whatever I was playing.
The sirens tell you you're wonderful and you're great and you're ordinary and you're this and you're that, and come this way right toward the rocks. just keep coming. Just keep coming here right toward the rocks. That's how this works. Those are the sirens. The sirens of injecting the myth of oneself in the furnace of present experience.
Right. Something to gain, something to lose.
Everything.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
All the hardships to get to an attainment.
You know them all.
Level.
Yep. You know them all. You could, you know, you could recite them if you did a one-man show about you. Right? We all could. Uh-huh. And that's our tendency, you see. We tend to process, we tend to interfere with the transmutative invitation of the present moment by first putting on a show, putting on a monologue. Where, you know, we're trying to entertain God with everything that we think, so that we'll be better understood and therefore placed in the right house. Gryffindor, Slytherin. Yeah. You think you're sitting under the sorting hat, but you're not. We prefer the myth of continuity and the myth of a certain kind of catharsis than the, you know, the unutterable simplicity of cessation.
Is that what they mean sometimes by losing yourself in presence that's so engaging?
Well, not necessarily that. I mean, you know, the idea of what, peak or flow, right? In other words, you become engrossed in whatever you're engrossed in. You could be, you know, dipping candles or jonesing on chocolate. And so you lose a sense of self-referencing. Runner's high.
It's like going the opposite direction, sort of, right?
Yes. Yeah, you could. Yeah, I think it's for sure fair to say opposite direction. If there were directions. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like you never really notice it's happening until after the fact. You're like, oh, shit. Where was I for the past and however long, you know?
Yeah.
I think I had a peak experience.
I might have had a peak experience. Right.
Yeah.
Let me check my odometer.
That's fine. Oh, wow. This is a peak experience. I was like,
how did I get up here?
There it goes, that peak experience.
Yeah. Right. This is the fun of it. This is the blasphemy of it. We return, let's say, reflexively to the role, the familiar role of being the recording and reporting mechanism. And the functionality of the recording and the reporting mechanism is the genesis of self. is the imposition of becoming an intermediary. Without fixation or clinging or grasping, which are metaphors that speak to the relaxation of narrative consciousness. Then those, the conclusions of self are, well, they evaporate. The poignant instructions that Nirsaga Dattas Guru, whose name I love to remember because it's so much fun to say it, but it escapes me now. Siddharameshwar.
Yeah.
Sri Siddharameshwar. His instructions to Nirsaga Datta, and of course I'm paraphrasing, I wasn't there. I might have been, but I've long since forgotten my prior life. Was for awareness to be attentive to awareness, or consciousness to be attentive to consciousness. A feedback loop. So rather than storyline and soliloquy being capturing or seducing awareness into the manufacture of self, the imperative was to simply, you know, rest in the tapasya of the heat of present experience. And if you're lucky, become engrossed, or at least nourished somehow by that discovery.
The instruction to bring attention to I am, that is a it's a little bit perplexing, or either that, or it's a bait and switch, because the I am is in a way it's in full grip, and it's the loosening of the I am. It seems to maybe it's like by delving into it with such fervor. You realize the emptiness of it.
Well, here is and has always been, though this refreshes with aplomb, this is that. I am that, this is that, this is that. And in that context, the so-called I am is neither I nor am. It doesn't have reference. It doesn't have any narrative. That's what's implied by I am that I am.
Right?
Yeah. Is, whoa, what, excuse me, what the fuck is this? And what's irrefutable is this curious pressure. Curious presentation of sentient availability. we dumb it down or ignore it by insisting on objects found in me as the subject. And that distracts our yogic attention from what's inferred by I am, because we've filled in the blank with a ludicrous, hysterical agenda, which looks like my life, or at least the story of my life. But the richness of this, or any of us, is this. This is the richness. Right? This is the portal and the revelation and the fruition of that tapasya. Tapasya is liberation. So the yogic encounter is to be, in a sense, steadfast enough, but in a very relaxed, right, non-clinging way, to allow this to transmute. That would include the ability from time to time to not flee, right? And fleeing means telling a story and, right, finding justifications and giving myself appointments and opinions and, right, flitting about with the imaginary content of the day or the life or the future. So the steadfastness suggests, here this is, check. And it's not going anywhere. It's not saying anything.
It's interesting. I'm reflecting on a moment, and I didn't go anywhere. And I didn't want to call the person in my presence a bitch. So I said, I need you to leave me alone.
Well done.
And then I got louder. I need you to fucking leave me alone.
Uh-huh.
You know? And then she left and said the word pathetic. But it was interesting. I didn't flee.
Nice. Good for you.
But I didn't want that energy.
Yeah, yeah.
I confronted that energy that was giving advice and telling me what I should do or not do. And it's like, instead of saying, fuck you, bitch, excuse me.
Yeah.
I certainly was thinking it. That doesn't get you anywhere.
Yeah.
To invite them to leave is different than fleeing. It's
yes.
It's different than fleeing.
So it is different.
Anyhow, that's the dance that I'm playing with.
Sure.
In my memory.
Well, you could have battled her. You know.
No, I did that once before, and it ended up being not good.
No, but I'm saying that would have been, in a way, that's sort of fleeing, you know, going battle. I mean, it's paradoxical.
The first time it happened, I said, why do you have to be such a bitch? That doesn't work very well. No. And then, fuck you, and this and that, and before you know it, the self is such a big presence.
You mean she didn't say, I understand.
No, she went in the house and locked herself.
This shit loves to escalate.
No, but the thing is, it's like staying present sometimes. Again, I'm just playing with this. Sometimes, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything more that needs to be said. Except that it wasn't fleeing, it was declaring in a way. The language of focusing, something.
A recognition.
Something was wanting to be left alone. Something in me was wanting to be left alone.
Yeah, of course.
Stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Enough.
Yeah. Yeah, someone's got a bullhorn up against your ear, you know, and you're gonna take steps.
And I think it's, again, a product of not wanting to flee. Because the pattern of just saying something and running. Right, so what's this have to do with inquiry?
Well, you know, the Hatha Yoga, Raja Yoga, if you want to get more poetic, are, you know, very much dedicated to establishing an asan, a seat, a posture, right? The full lotus or half lotus or whatever, right, creates a pyramidal structure, itself being, you know, crystalline. So energy flows through it. And the Kundalini metaphor, Ida Shushumna, the Ida, the Pingala, the Shushumna, and the various energy centers, is another metaphor for the maturation of ojas, or, you know, spiritual so-called fluid energy, rising up through the channels without resistance, without distortion or distraction. So one establishes the asan, which is not fleeing. And so we do that, informally, conversationally, through the thrill of the enticement and reflection of one's own self consideration. Yeah. But, and that's just, you know, another Socratic style of establishing the asan and finding release through the transmutation of distortion rather than the tendency to flee, which interferes with the right medicine doing its job. Mm. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So all of these systems are, they're lovely metaphors for each other, whether it's the Vipassana style or the lighter mindfulness or like jhana practice, whatever, right?
Alchemy in a way.
Yeah, that's right. Your liberation is alchemy. And up to through, let's say, many stages, it is a working or functioning alchemy. I am the alchemist, and I'm going to apply the skills and training of the alchemy to, right, participate in a transmutation process, which does itself. My job is to flee less and less and less and less, to flee less, which suggests some degree of maturation, steadfastness, intimate encounter with heat and pressure, the tapasya of present experience, and riding that out, riding that through. That's the instruction that was given to Nirsagadatta from Siddharameshwar, which he had the good karma to be able to follow at that, you know, so-called stage of his life. His immersion came about deeply and profoundly with hardly any interference. Through that, the gift of that yoga, he went full diamond. We're doing the same. Some people might say that's, you know, hubris. And I would say, go fuck yourself.
Well, that makes me
See?
Yeah, and they would be right. But they would be fleeing.
That's right, they would be.
Uh-huh, yeah. That's the difference.
Hubris implies a very strong sense of self.
Yeah.
And self-importance.
Yeah.
Well, seeing that, I'm sure it's easy to see it then.
Yeah,
because you're not playing into the conformity.
That's right.
Of the investment of the self, the world of selves.
Yeah,
I'd say.
People like to put themselves in the role, and they say, "Well,
we're
me doing it." Then it would definitely be.
Yeah, you know that we're clearly capable of finding any crumb lying around and turning it into a fortress of pride. We'll do that over and over again. Right? The slightest crumb turned into a fortress of pride. So, Sadhu Sabdan was a prescient reminder for the aspirant in this adventure to beware, be on the lookout for the, the ease in which practice and steadfastness and yogic accomplishment, which does come, can be turned into pride of ownership, pride of accomplishment. And just like the last temptation of Christ, Christ had gone up to a very high level of heat. And at the last minute there on the cross, when things were looking kind of bleak, the serpent, right, teased him off the cross. And he was like, so relieved. Really relieved, and jumped off the cross and had wives and sheep, goats and children, music and wine, and a full belly, and a beautiful life. Until his dear friend, who hung himself in the, vineyard, came back and said, "Knock, knock, hello, it's me, Judas, you asshole. You got tripped up." Because right there in the midst of Jesus's satisfying life was the serpent, still ageless as the young girl that tempted him off the cross in the first place, keeping an eye out. And Judas reminded Jesus that he had been tripped up. Sadhu Sabdan, right? Be vigilant, be aware. Because this heat is profound, and as the transmutation occurs, it's very easy to turn a crumb into a citadel of pride, which is what Jesus did more or less as relief, not necessarily, but like, oh, thank God, I don't have to be consumed on this cross, because that was really painful. So when his dear friend reminded him of his oath, He willingly returned to the cross to complete his transmutation. And hey, we're doing the same. Everyone's doing the same. I'm not singling anybody out. That's what this shit is. It's a profound, more than profound, unutterable tapestry of magnificence. Sensual magnificence, the siren song. And there's no harm in fleeing, or let's say choosing unconsciously not to participate in transmutation. There's no points, right? No one's held in any higher or lower regard or esteem. If it's your curious karma to take this as far as it might take you, then it will comply. it will comply and you will comply. And there's a marriage then. Emptiness is so effusive. We will take up residence in the effusion. And so our satisfactions and dissatisfactions by thus taking up residence in the effusion. The yogi turns his or her back on the effusive nature of corporeal sensuality, not as a renunciation, because that becomes another vehicle for pride, but just for the impossible thrill of what liberation might portend.
A little bit of seeing through it, too.
That's useful. Yeah. Yeah. Yuji Krishnamurti referred to it as a calamity.
Yeah.
That he wouldn't wish upon anyone.
Do you think what he was referring to when he was talking about his own calamity? It sounded so physical.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to be able to see that much.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the yogic maturing of liberation is calamitous. You know, someone I know who was close enough to Paul Hederman to inquire of his experience was very candid and happy to acknowledge a lengthy period of disorienting calamity. Painful. You know, tapas.
It was just a period, though. It didn't last, right?
No, now he just has, a crappy bunch of friends and a really bad knee.
And for Krishnamurti as well. Just talking about a period of time?
Well, no.
He said he was a crab all the way to the end.
Touché.
Tune in once. It's strange.
Well, there was a crescendo in, you know, the comic book story of the night of Krishnamurti's so-called liberation. It's, quite over-dramatized. Maybe it's under-dramatized. I wasn't there. Maybe I was. I don't know. And he had these, what he called the process, I think, these really severe headaches. And he did continue to have those curious headaches for some number of years, long past the catharsis of his, you know.
But they stopped? Or did he die of brain cancer or something?
No.
They may have stopped. They may have stopped. I don't remember.
I think they subsided.
I think they subsided.
I thought it was just a period.
But, you know, he also had the curious experience. It was reported that he had forgotten that his own memory had been erased.
Yeah,
not in its entirety. It's not like his wife had turned into a hat. That kind of, erasure. But a lot of the content of his memory, which just kind of became, unavailable to recall with any confidence. And so people that were close to him at his, request, were happy to fill in the blanks. But he remarked on several occasions that he just didn't remember.
You wonder shit. If there was some organic thing going on.
He was one strange motherfucker. I mean, there's cool stories of people sitting with him, and he would go into this kind of trance. You know, the process would come on or the pain would come on, and then his body would go limp and his, casual consciousness would leave the body or leave the room. and then some other kind of entity would like speak on his behalf. And people that were around when this happened were like, so let's like back up slow toward the door. It was, you know, pretty bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. There's fun stories about, you know, that.
Yeah. Traumatic childhood or something you heard? Didn't he? Wasn't like a real integrated person to begin with.
No, not necessarily. He had, I think, childhood malaria, and which might have contributed to his, you know, dizzy gazing about.
I just remember because one person had remarked like that was the difference between the two Krishnamurtis was like a. You know, not that he had a. You know, I think she described it as. Proper amount of bonding or love or some thing, whatever normal psychological
occurring
between the two. And
well, sure. I mean,
didn't have it
Jay Krishnamurti. I think he and his lovely brother Nitya lost their mom early on, so their father, who was I guess working or whatever, you know, was their guardian or their physical, you know, biological father, and having a hard time making ends meet, of course. And along came the robust Madame Blavatsky and the power of the Theosophical, you know, cosmic movement, and Ledbetter, who was on the lookout for a beautiful young boy that he could admire, perhaps in a carnal way. And so they found Krishnamurti, and Blavatsky fell in love with him for his spiritual capacity, and Ledbetter fell in love with him for more prurient interests. So you could say that he was whisked out of his father's care because the Theosophist came along with a fistful of cash and more or less kidnapped with his father's consent. And I guess and Krishnamurti would not go unless Nitya, his younger brother, came along. He was just adamant. They were inseparable. So, yeah, Krishnamurti and his dad and Nitya all consented to the being raised in the, you know, the wealth and curiosity of the early Theosophists, and they were just full of, let's just call it various forms of extraterrestrialism and mediumship and shit. You know, they weren't steeped in the
cosmic, white fire.
Yeah, white and dark. I mean, the whole fucking daily thing. Well, that's the Russian. You know, that's kind of a Russian thing.
Yeah,
Russian mysticism is just, well, it's, they're all fucking tanked on, you know, vodka. So their mysticism gets really, you know, bleak and strange, like their winters.
A treatise on the cosmic fire.
Yeah. So Krishnamurti, in that case, was raised in a very curious, you know, situation as a youngster. Yeah. And part of his catharsis with the Theosophical Society and the mysticisms that were being perpetrated on a regular basis as part of that society came when his brother Nitya had tuberculosis, and Krishnamurti was on an ocean voyage from, you know, India to UK or UK to the West Coast or wherever the fuck. And he was promised beyond a shadow of a doubt that Nitya would recover, and learned on this ocean voyage that his dear brother had passed. Mm. And I think he was livid. He was pissed. He was, you know, shaken by the loss of his brother and the falsifications of the promises that had been made that through cosmic interventions all would be well. And he was like,
a boy at the time?
No, he was a young man now. Mm-hmm. I think his, you know, the famous speech of the disbanding of the Order of the Star, I think he was 33 around there. So it was shortly before then at the house in Ojai, California, which I think now might be part of the Krishnamurti Foundation or Museum,
is
where his, you know, so-called awakening catharsis occurred.
How young was he when he took him?
Was
like, oh, he might have been a preteen.
Yeah, I think he was 12 or something.
Young. Yeah, no, not infancy, yeah.
No, he was
a preteen.
Considered the avatar.
Yeah. Maitreya.
Talk about taking your avatar off. He did.
He took his avatar off as soon as he could.
We're done.
Yeah. You, and you, get out of my face. Yeah. It's a great speech. I mean, you can see it on YouTube. He was, you know, beautiful and beautiful, and he had his microphone, and he spoke with this, you know, quiet, profound conviction as he disbanded the Order of the Star, and everyone freaked the fuck out.
I don't know if I ever saw that. I wonder, you think it's fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You can see it.
I wonder if there's an audible gasp.
Yeah. Oh, I went to, you know, I went to a number of Krishnamurti talks that I could get my hands on, and occasionally you would find nutty people, you know, in the audience, either go off on wild tangents or plead with him for healings and shit like that, and he would just go, Jesus Christ. One time he muttered under his breath into the microphone, Jesus Christ. That was pretty funny. Yeah, yeah. I was at one in Ojai, I think it was a talk on his, oh my God, was it his, could have been his 90th birthday.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it was his actual 90th birthday. We were in Ojai listening to Kay, you know, whip on it, and somebody was carrying on, and he just said something like, "Madam, what do you think I'm trying to do?" You know, she was complaining, and he was like, "I'm giving you the best I got. I'm 90, you know." And he was very funny. He, of course, the people that were running the Krishnamurti Foundation were perpetual beggars, right, for generous donations all the time. You have to be, I guess, like Our Lady of Guadalupe or whatever. And he said, "I was asked to remind you that it is the speaker's 90th birthday." And it was just a great chuckle throughout the crowd, because he would often refer to himself in third person, you know, as the speaker or something.
Right.
And he says, "Please make no special indication, you know, about that." But encouraged whatever donations, you know. It was funny. It was kind of delightful. He had that wonderful capacity to be very provocative and very intimate in a very large, you know, gathering of people. He was just good at it, so good at it. There's a great recording of students at the University of San Diego that were giving him a really, really hard time, you know, college kids and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he quieted them all down and was able to get under their skin and deliver this, you know, most sweet message of palpable liberation. And you're like, how did he do that?
Yeah.
And he would just sit on a bridge chair, you know, sitting on his hands and with a microphone, and he would just take you out.
Yeah.
It was good. Really good. He would just take you out.
And is Jeddu related at all?
No. No, I don't believe there was any blood relation between them.
Yeah, it didn't seem as such. And watching the one thing.
Yeah.
Seems like UG just got pissed off with everybody. Certainly with Jay.
Oh,
well,
but, you know, with just about anybody.
He was his best as a, you know, the ultimate spiritual curmudgeon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess, you know, it lights up that part of the spectrum.
Absolutely.
And it's, as opposed to saying, "I'm too miserable to get it." And say, "Oh no, he's my teacher.
Yeah,
he's miserable too."
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, for him it was a calamity. It was a disturbing, you know, discontinuous calamity that ruined his, you know, personality.
Before, ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
After, fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. It is, I mean, this is understandably unnerving. You participate in a group hallucination of space-time, body-mind, and Genesis and birth and death and being a consequence of forces outside and other than yourself. So you're fragmented. You're split, isolated and individuated. And that's what we learn to cope with, rather dysfunctionally, but that's what we learn to cope with. The path back to what we might agree is sobriety for most people is, you know, heresy, absolute heresy. We've come to speak about things in a more or less casual manner that for most people is institutionalizable. And fuck you. Tough.
Yeah, I think there's a certain, I guess, false security in one self dealing with another self. And then when someone goes, this is no more substantive than air, divesting.
Yeah.
You go, oh. Well, then who will you be in the next moment?
That's right.
I know.
Fuck if I know.
It's like, geez, how can we, we deal with you?
Yeah. Well, you become the weather, no longer the weatherman.
There you go. Yeah, I'm seeing that guy on the roof of his tractor, his trailer. Weather reporter and smoke signals.
Oh, right. Smoke signals.
Saw a tractor trailer go by today.
Really?
Not much happening here.
Exactly.
The sun came up.
Major weather report. Yeah. Dry, warm, in the 70s. Back to you, Chuck.
It's really funny to speak of people and the point of perspective as being a weatherman.
Yeah.
The weatherman is just talking about the shit that's flying.
That's right.
Dorothy.
Yeah, got a low pressure system up my own sphincter. It's pretty stormy.
Better than high pressure and an expulsion.
Yeah. You got that right. Boy, time does fly when you're having fun.
No, is it? Is it over?
I guess it's over.
Is there an envelope under here? No.
Yeah, I keep the envelopes in my car where they belong. Thanks for joining us, everyone. 5 viewers, that's a record. I hope we entertained you. Thanks for being with us. Good night.